This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. It is 7:01 on Wednesday, the 16th of July.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
This is Sonia.
And Jesse.
And Marty.
And we've got a show with quite a wide variety of stuff, I feel, that we've got a really diverse show coming up for you this morning. But perhaps we should thank Earth Matters before we begin on our things, the 3CR's national programme for social justice and environment issues, broadcasting from the Sustainability Festival this week.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you, Earth Matters.
Mm, indeed. Thank you.
Right. What have we got on the show this week?
Well, we'll begin with the second part of an interview that Wednesday Breakfast co-host Nita did with two Iranian activists, Axel, a freelance geopolitics analyst, and another anonymous Iranian activist. Nita was interviewing them and speaking to them about the 12-day war between Iran and Israel. Just, you know, last month, I think, ended. And just doing a bit of analysis, figuring out, you know, what led up to it and what's going on now. And in this second part, they discuss, you know, whether the balance of power has shifted following those 2 weeks and, you know, what's likely to happen next.
And if you didn't catch the first part, it's on our page on 3cr.org.au, and it's really worth listening to.
After that, we'll have a quick chat with Roscoe Lee Brown of Radio Rada, and Roscoe will tell us and give us some more updates on Kanaki Indigenous Liberation news from the Oceania region and beyond, including updates on the International Seabed Authority, talking about Aquanullius, or the plan to divide up the seabed for rare earth mineral mining.
And after that, we will be talking to Angelica from Market Forces. She's the gas campaigner there, and we'll be talking about who's now funding the fracking of the Beetaloo Basin and what we can do about it.
And after that, we'll chat with Kelly Flanagan, who's a Wiradjuri woman, recently released from the Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, a women's maximum security prison. And Kelly is helping to organise a rally this afternoon at 12 p.m. at 121 Exhibition Street. And that's to call for shine a light and raise awareness on the horrible conditions that women are experiencing in the Dame Phyllis Frost Centre and try to hold those responsible to account.
And there's another rally coming up at the start of next month. And if we get through all of those items, and hopefully we will, and then get to Claire from the Save Public Housing Collective, which will be holding a rally on August 2. And Claire can update us with what's been going on with the towers in both Carlton, North Melbourne and Flemington. Go on.
It's a great idea to demolish public housing when we're in a housing crisis.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Makes so much sense.
Yeah. So regular listeners will have heard a lot about that subject over probably a long time now. It's reached a pretty dire situation, but it'd be great to have Claire on. Tell us where it's at.
But before that, let's do some news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to
And beginning our news headlines for this Wednesday morning, the 16th of July, leaked confidential files suggest a veteran British spy, Nicholas Langman, infiltrated the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, on behalf of MI6 British Intelligence. This alleged infiltration supports Iran's long-standing accusations that the nuclear watchdog has colluded with its adversaries to undermine its sovereignty and facilitate economic pressure. The reporting from the Grey Zone details Langman's controversial background, including past accusations of involvement in sensitive intelligence operations and his significant role in orchestrating economic sanctions on Iran between 2010 and 2012. His resume, found in documents linked to British intelligence, explicitly credits him with engineering the economic pressure that has crippled the Iranian economy. This revelation raises serious questions about the impartiality of the IAEA and its role in international nuclear diplomacy. With Langman claiming influence over the agency, critics argue that the IAEA may have been compromised, potentially providing intelligence that contributed to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists and influencing reports that preceded military actions against Iran.
President Donald Trump has announced a new military aid strategy for Ukraine, unveiled on July the 14th, following a meeting with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. The plan involves selling billions of dollars in US military equipment to NATO countries, which would then transfer the weapons to Ukraine, with European nations shouldering the financial burden. This approach aims to sustain Ukraine's defence while preserving American military stockpiles. In addition to the arms deal, Trump issued an ultimatum to Russia, stating that if a peace agreement is not reached within 50 days, he will impose a 100% tariff on Russian goods. Furthermore, he threatened secondary tariffs on countries that continue to trade significantly with Russia, specifically mentioning China and India. While implementing these aggressive economic measures, Trump seeks to distance himself from the ongoing conflict, often referring to it as a Biden war or Democrat war. This dual strategy reflects a desire to both exert pressure on Russia and shift political responsibility, even as Russia maintains its steadfast demands for Ukrainian neutrality and recognition of annexed territories in any potential peace settlement.
And the 17th BRICS summit, held in Rio de Janeiro, July 6th to 7th, concluded with a strong denunciation of unilateral efforts by the United States to disrupt global trade through tariff wars. Leaders from BRICS nations, including new member Indonesia, reaffirmed their commitment to fostering a more equitable and inclusive global order, emphasising the need for comprehensive reforms in existing multilateral institutions. The summit produced the Strengthening Global South Cooperation for Inclusive and Sustainable Governance Declaration, outlining 126 commitments across various sectors, including politics, security, economy, finance, and culture. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva highlighted BRICS's role as a successor to the non-aligned movement, advocating for enhanced legitimacy and democratic character within global governance bodies like the UN, IMF, and the World Bank. Beyond economic and institutional reforms, the BRICS nations collectively condemned recent Israeli-US military strikes in Iran and Israel's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza, demanding adherence to international law. The declaration also called for increased cooperation in global AI and health governance, while identifying hunger and poverty as fundamental causes for socially determined diseases, underscoring a broad commitment to global stability and human well-being.
And Israel has reportedly issued a warning to residents of Gaza, banning entry into the Mediterranean Sea under penalty of death. This severe restriction, which extends beyond fishing to include swimming and bathing, is being widely condemned by critics as an act of economic, social, and psychological warfare rather than a legitimate security measure. The Titan ban exacerbates the already dire humanitarian situation in Gaza, where infrastructure is decimated and clean water is scarce. For many Gazans, the sea has long served as a vital source of livelihood for fishers, a crucial means of cooling off amidst extreme heat, and a rare respite from the pervasive conflict. Their prohibition deprives them of essential resources and what little relief they could find. While the IDF maintains the blockade is a security measure to prevent weapon smuggling, Palestinian officials and residents view it as a deliberate tactic of slow, deliberate suffocation. The policy has ignited international outrage, with human rights advocates globally denouncing the ban and questioning its military justification, emphasizing the profound and destructive impact on an already besieged population.
Justice advocates, including the group Justice Not Jails and the family of Kumanjai Walker, have vehemently criticised Northern Territory Chief Minister Leah Finocchiaro for downplaying the findings of the inquest into Mr. Walker's police shooting death. The Chief Minister's focus on the inquest's duration, rather than its substantive conclusions, has drawn widespread condemnation for trivialising systemic issues. Coroner Elizabeth Armitage's inquest delivered damning findings, citing clear evidence of entrenched, systemic and structural racism within the NT police, and explicitly stating that Constable Rolfe's racist attitude increased the likelihood of the fatal outcome. Despite these unequivocal judicial findings, Ms. Finocchiaro has consistently defended the NT police, denied systemic racism, and even scrapped a planned review into racism within the force. This stance creates a significant rift between the government's narrative and the call for accountability and urgent reform from justice advocates and the Indigenous community.
And finally, this Wednesday morning, a landmark climate change case brought by Torres Strait Islander traditional owners against the Australian government has been dismissed by the federal court, despite judicial acknowledgement that the islands are being ravaged by climate change. The court ruled that the government does not owe a legal duty of care to protect these vulnerable communities from the impacts of climate change, deeming emissions targets a matter of, quote, high or core government policy beyond common law negligence. The case, which was initiated in 2021, argued that the government's failure to act on scientific advice regarding greenhouse gas emission reductions jeopardised communities at risk of becoming Australia's first climate change refugees. While the court accepted evidence of severe impacts like sea level rise, erosion and flooding, it concluded that cultural loss, a central tenet of the traditional owner's claim, is not recognised as compensable. Thank you very much. Compensable harm under Australian law. So that's a weird one, isn't it? Not compensable under Australian law. Kind of sort of shifts it out of their responsibility, doesn't it? The traditional owners, Uncle Pubai Pubai and Uncle Paul Cabai, expressed profound heartbreak and shock at the decision, reiterating their deep love for their families and communities as their driving motivation. Their grief, echoed by Auntie Macrose Alou, extends to future generations as the ruling leaves them without legal recourse to protect their ancestral lands and cultural heritage from the escalating threats of climate change. Well, some extraordinary news headlines there today, yeah, isn't there? Yeah. That is the final news headline, by the way, but there's some real doozies in there.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
I mean, it doesn't strike me as coincidental that there was a video that came out of a young Palestinian boy enjoying time in the waves, saying that this is the only thing that's making him happy. And the same day was the ban on swimming in the ocean. It just strikes me as, far too frequent to be coincidental. But
okay.
Maybe we should go to a song or something after that, rather than going straight into.
We can do that.
Yeah, let's have a song. What have we got, Marty? That's
Let's see what we've got on this Wednesday morning. How about something from Kayan?
Sounds good.
This is Better Things. I think it is. It is. And we're back. And hang on, just let me find some headphones here, folks. That is a ripper song. That's Better Things from Kayan, who is actually performing on July 18. That's this Friday. As part of the what's it called? It's a showcase. Collective Artist Showcase at the Northcote Social Club, which is part of a 20th anniversary celebration of the mighty Northcote Social Club. That's Friday, July 18. Also playing is Swap Meat, Rice Wine, DJ Queenie and others. Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Thanks, Marty. Let's head to the first segment, which is an interview with two Iranian activists, Axel, a freelance geopolitics analyst, and an anonymous Iranian activist. This is the second part, and in this part we're discussing whether the balance of power has shifted following the 12-day war between Iran and Israel.
So you've touched a little bit, you both touched on where Iran is situated within the global balance of power, hashing out dynamics within the West Asian region, but also its relationship to Russia and China, and also generally the relationship of the West to Russia and China. Do you think that Iran's position within the global balance of power has shifted after this 12-day war?
Well, I think, to be honest, it's too early to say, like, about after these 12 days. But my understanding of Iran's state is, like, historically, Iran has been a country since the time of finding oil in Iran and extracting oil. Iran's economy have been shaped in form of selling raw material, oil, raw resources, and buying goods. So that makes like the merchant bourgeoisie a big economical class in Iran, maybe the most powerful economical class in Iran. And it's after the revolution, after 1979 revolution, it has stayed the same. Like, it seems that the most powerful class in Iran that manages to kind of dictate the Iranian state's policies in their own interest is the merchant bourgeoisie. And because of that, Iran, I think, that's like kind of the economical class. And from the other side, there is some religious element, and the animosity with Israel comes from that angle, puts Iran in a confused position when it comes to geopolitical decisions. In one hand, the Iranian ruling class, they like to have a connection with the West. They always have had that desire to connect to the West. But at the same time, for the religious reasons, and also from the background of history with the United States and Israel, there is an animosity with Israel, which makes its first agenda, or like the first desire, kind of impossible. So they want to connect to the West, and kind of they, in many senses, some of the powerful classes in Iran, bourgeoisie class in Iran, yearn to have a relationship with the West. But at the same time, because of this conflict with Israel, it's not possible. It doesn't go ahead. And it's like, at least for two decades, one of the main doctrines of Iran's current supreme leader was turning towards the East. But we don't see much of the effective relationship building moves from the Iranian state towards that policy of turning to the East, either with China or with India or Russia. We don't see much of, because, you know, it's not just about military or intelligence cooperation. Most of these things make sense when you have economical interests at stake. And usually countries become allies or strategic allies first through economical connections to each other, and then through military and security and intelligence or defense. So in the last 20 years, I believe that there have been many opportunities to build that. And when something like that doesn't happen, it just makes you think that it's deliberate. It seems that the Iranian state usually have a kind of always showed up that they're turning towards the East to come to a peace with the West, not a genuine connection towards the East. So, it seems to me that Iran's position, for these two main reasons that I mentioned, is geopolitically confused. Of course, there are between countries like Russia, China, Iran, or countries in the BRICS or in the south of the world, there is, as being a nation state and all that sort of stuff, there are conflicts of interest to some extent. But these conflicts of interest aren't such that, their interest, their common interest in working with each other is much heavier than the conflicts of interest between them. And I believe that the reason it's not as developed as it should be is that Iran is geopolitically confused and has been like that for decades.
Thanks for that. Do you have anything to add to that, Axel?
Yeah, probably a bit of context around why the situation is like that. As I see it, it goes back to the history of the revolution in Iran. The revolution in Iran must be understood as an alliance of classes that revolted against a emerging comprador bourgeoisie, if you like, or a bourgeoisie or a capitalist class that was following, pursuing a dependent model of development in Iran, if you like, one that is like geared towards the interests of the developed world, that was trying to dictate that model to many of the developing countries coming out of the entering the 20th century. In reaction to that, an alliance was formed between the older, like, mercantilist and the petty bourgeoisie of Iran, which were heavily undermined by these developments, and the working class that was divided in terms of these political representatives and manifestations. The revolution that came out of this situation very soon degenerated into some sort of competition between the forces that emerged out of the revolution. And this brought Iran to a situation that is very hard to be called revolutionary, in the sense that the clergy or the theocracy that prevailed in the revolution was that class that was in a very close alliance with the bazaar, with the mercantilist bourgeoisie, old mercantilist bourgeoisie of Iran. And the thing that they were best at was to just buy and sell, you know, to import things, which is much easier than producing. This policy was pursued, especially after the one government, state power, and the old revenue. So there was a lot of opportunity for Iran to use this revenue for R&D and to replace, to become more resilient economically, to replace its external needs with some sort of, you know, alliance with the East, as well as like some sort of self-sufficiency, which we can see that was happened largely in its military program. So we can see like this is possible and it's doable. But at the same time, each time the sanctions were eased, like Iran moved towards like importing more goods, more consumer goods, or, you know, just the easiest way of fulfilling the needs, which is very incompatible with an economy that is under such a harsh confrontation with the imperialist bloc. At the same time, also the neoliberal policies that were pursued in Iran were in the interest of a specific class of of crony and corrupt bourgeoisie that was ruling or close semi-private or private or state in the state. But bottom line, that they were all against the interests of the majority of the people, the proletariat of Iran, if you like. Especially after the 2011 oil embargoes on Iran, life got extremely difficult and the quality of life dropped for a vast majority of the Iranian population. Even simple things as the provision of basic welfare services like healthcare, like housing, transportation, these things were highly missed. And this opened door to a lot of alienation inside the country. At the same time, this ruling class, in the interest of maintaining its cohesion of its base, alienated other social groups in Iran over questions of like veiling questions, so social questions like the presence and manifestation and participation of more secular forces or forces that were not closely aligned with their Shia doctrines in Iran. So all these things combined undermined Iran in very different forms, various different forms, and like it ended up like being ruled by heavy hand of a state that is very hard to be called revolutionary, whereas at the same time it was in conflict and it is still in conflict with imperialism. So it's a very difficult situation that at the same time it makes difficult, probably you can speculate that it must have made it difficult for, say, China as a defining force in international relations to trust Iran as a potential ally. And this fluctuations and this flimsy switchbacks between East and West, as your other guest also very mentioned in more details. That's a bit of context around like how we ended up in this situation.
Thanks for that. Definitely that, I guess, posture against imperialism, you know, can instantly be read as revolutionary. And I think that is certainly the way that Iran is read by much of the global South. But I think, it's quite apparent that the internal politics perhaps would not be described necessarily as revolutionary based on what you've said.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we're going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
Hey. I got a message for you, you got a message for me. One day we'll come together and sit down by the fire.
Every Wednesday at 11 a.m, join me, Bunzolini, at the fire
on Community Radio 3CR.
Three hours of historically informed, critical analysis of Aboriginal affairs and the ongoing political movement for land rights, treaty, sovereignty and the cessation of genocide. Featuring the best of black music. Bunzel's Fire. 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. every Wednesday on Community Radio 3CR. Who's gonna lead us? Who's gonna follow? Show me the way,
show me the way, show me the way. And you're back on 3CR Wednesday morning at 7:33. We just heard an interview regarding the recent 12-day war between Israel and Iran and a bit of geopolitical analysis. But this morning, right now, we're lucky to be joined by Roscoe Lee Brown of Radio Rada. Good morning, Roscoe. How are you this morning?
Hey, Jesse. How you going? Morning, listeners. Roscoe Lee Brown here, coming to you from Sandon Point, from the Sandon Point Embassy there near Wollongong, Karaji. I'm here with old Uncle Peter Button.
Oh, wow. Can you tell us where is that exactly? I'm sorry, I didn't know.
Wollongong. Good morning, Roscoe.
Wollongong. Yeah. Good morning, yes. Yeah.
Great neck of the woods.
Yeah, fantastic place. I sent you a little video there of the sun coming up this morning, my view looking up to Sydney. A bit hard to leave here. I'm heading out today off to Newcastle to do the first of the Bonoir's coffee pop-ups. But I'm sitting here with Uncle Peter Button. With the sacred fire. They've been here, Sandon Point Embassy, 25 years.
Yeah.
December the 20th this year coming up. There's a 25th anniversary. Old fellas there prowling around the front of the embassy here this morning looking for stones. We've been collecting stones, river stones, for the fire.
Wow. That's incredible, Roscoe.
Yeah, and drinking coffee.
and drinking coffee. Yeah, cool. Every morning. Got to have coffee every day. How are you going to get through the day without a coffee?
Hmm.
Radio writer runs on coffee.
Yes, yes, literally. Roscoe, you've got a few updates for us. Kanaki, the Seabed Authority, Torres Strait climate case. What's been happening?
Well, I thought we'd start with the Kanaki this morning. So after a year of what the French might call troubles, the New Caledonia territory of Kanaki, this week the French, or in Paris, President Emmanuel Macron convened a get-together of what he called the relevant parties in a conversation about the reconstruction of New Caledonia, or Kanaki. Remembering, dear listener, that Kanaki is a French Pacific territory 2 hours off the coast of Australia on the Tropic of Capricorn. Since May 13 last year, there's been, you'd have to call it a civil war of sorts in that territory. The French are trying to move 45,000 people to New Caledonia, trying to gerrymander the electoral roll in New Caledonia because Kanaki got control of the parliament for the first time. And this week, just gone in Paris, a meeting was convened of what Macron called the relevant parties. Of course, that meeting was convened without any representation from customary owners, traditional owners, First Nations people, or women. And they've come to the conclusion that they won't deliver independence as demanded by the Kanaki people for that territory. They'll deliver a sort of autonomy, an administrative autonomy, with a referendum in February next year to decide whether the community want to proceed with full independence. Now, remember that since 1988, a thing called the Noumea Accords, the last time this place blew up between 74 and 84, since 1988, there has been a UN-mandated self-government blueprint in force, and Macron, when he became the French president, the second thing he said was New Caledonia is France, and he has worked tirelessly to derail that self-determination, that self-governance, that independent track, and he's now managed it. They overthrew the Kanaki government in a coup on Christmas Eve, just gone, and now they've managed to come up with an agreement that will deliver what they're calling an autonomy, a state within France, with a referendum in February 26th. There's already been three referenda about this question. The Kanaki do not want to be French. They want independence.
Mm, of course. Can you remind us why the French government is so hell-bent on keeping this colony?
I guess it's a combination of geopolitics and money. Massive nickel deposits in that part of the world. Also, massive seabed nickel deposits in that part of the world. And also, the French, the Americans, the Australians, the Brits are all concerned about the Pacific and China's aspirations in the Pacific. And New Caledonia, or as Kanaki as it's known by the locals, is part of that geopolitical enterprise. There's a massive naval base in New Caledonia, in Kanaki. French nuclear submarines already prowl around that part of the world. And our AUKUS submarine proposal, the treaty, whatever you want to call it, with America and Britain, is about nuclear-powered submarines.
Yeah. And the International Seabed Authority ratification meeting, that's started in Kingston, is that right?
It has started in Kingston. It's running all of the way through July. Delegates from around the world are gathering. They're trying to divide up the seabed. This is a thing called the International Seabed Authority, a United Nations sponsored and sanctioned body. It is meeting this July until the 25th to ratify the mining code for 70% of the world's oceans, to divide them up into 75,000 square kilometre mining leases.
Mm.
Now, one of the most important things about this is that the United Nations and the International Seabed Authority says that the oceans are unowned.
Yeah.
This is an aqua nullius, the same as terra nullius. They're saying that nobody owns the ocean, so therefore corporations and member states can come to agreements about creating mining leases on the seabed. Turns out that where freshwater vents into salt water, in the water column, all the little animals up to the size of calamari, they ingest the freshwater and they pass it out as copper, gold, and rare earth.
Mm.
The seabed, the silt on the seafloor, is going to go and power your telephones, dear listener.
Mm.
They're going to let corporations and member states divide the ocean up into mining lots and suck this material up in huge vacuum cleaners.
So is this like a kind of 21st century Berlin conference scenario where, you know, all these world powers will get together and draw lines and claim territory?
Yeah, it's precisely the kind of thing, Jesse. That's what the fear is, or that's what the reality is. The Berlin Conference, for the dear listener, will know that at the end of the 19th century, all of the European powers got together and they got their little Sharpies out and a map of Africa, and they divided it up and handed the resources to the various countries. This is a similar idea. They've taken out the map of the world, taken out 70% of the world's oceans, and are dividing it up into mining lots that corporations and member states can negotiate about. It's called the Enterprise. How about that?
Wow.
They're actually calling it the Enterprise.
Wow.
This gathering comes hot on the heels of new research in the potential environmental impacts of mining the seabed, and also comes, you know, not very long after U.S. President the Trumpet signed an executive order designed to open up U.S. and international waters to mining companies.
Mm-hmm.
But the pressure's mounting on the ISA. The hope is that organizations like the ones we're in contact with, dear listener, the Deep Currents Collective, an international group of scholars, artists, lawyers, and activists, have been campaigning for a moratorium and are trying to prosecute that case at this meeting in Jamaica over July.
Okay, and you had an update on the Torres Strait climate case as well.
Yeah, yesterday in the federal court in Cairns, Saibai Islanders have been campaigning for the longest time now, trying to get the Australian government to take responsibility for sea level rise in their part of the world. Now, people who know the history of the Torres Strait will know that the Saibai Islanders a group of Saibai Islanders were moved in the 1950s to Seishia and Bamingha at the tip of Cape York because the island was becoming inundated. Now, the descendants of those people have started court action and were in the federal court yesterday trying to get the federal government to take responsibility for the sea level rise in that part of the world. Unfortunately, the federal court ruled that they do not have the jurisdiction to rule on this matter, and so set it aside. And so it's a bit of a setback for the campaign, but it's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The Saibai Islanders now have the opportunity to take this to the High Court. The federal court is suggesting that the Australian government might be able to legislate an outcome for the Saibai Islanders. I wouldn't have thought that would be particularly practicable, but it's not the end of the world, apparently. But it is very disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely. So they'll be able to continue that fight.
Yeah, well, the ruling says the applicants have not succeeded in making their primary case in negligence. So it was a negligence action. You know, it was about what the Australian government are not doing.
Mm.
The Commonwealth did not and does not owe Torres Strait Islanders the duty of care alleged by the applicants, according to the federal court. Justice Michael Wigney in the federal court brought down that brought down that decision. This piece of litigation has been regarded as one of the, you know, kind of most important climate-style litigations going anywhere in the world. It was brought against the Australian government. The plaintiffs, Saibai Islanders, argued the Commonwealth had a duty of care to protect Torres Strait Islanders from climate change by reducing emissions and building seawalls. That case has failed in the federal court in Cairns yesterday.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time this morning, Roscoe. Was there any last things, anything you'd like to plug before we let you go?
Yeah, shameless plug for what we're coming to call the Black Cafe. About to start a pop-up in Newcastle, which will be coming to Melbourne before Christmas. A cafe, coffee supplied by liberation forces around the world, Jamaica, Kanaki, West Papua coffee, the beans coming from precisely the people that are campaigning for their, what do we want to call them, their customary right. Mm. All of the proceeds from the sale of these beans and from the purchases, cups of coffee, go towards funding liberation, freedom and restitution across the ocean kingdoms of the world.
Thank you, Roscoe. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, we need to know when we can get that coffee here in Melbourne, Roscoe. Keep us up to date.
Yeah, well, I'll be there in about 4 weeks.
Awesome. We'll see you then.
No problem.
Have a great
day. Thanks, everybody.
Roscoe.
Thank you, dear listener. Roscoe Lee Brown for Radio Rada. Enjoy your day.
See you.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favourite radio program is produced? On Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2025. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July. See you then.
And that was Roscoe Lee Brown talking from Radio Rata. Next up, keeping on with, you know, things that we're doing that are rubbish in our oceans and to our water supply and things like that, we've got Angelica, who is the Market Forces new gas campaigner. Regular listeners might remember Rachel, who has moved on to the
Sunrise Movement.
Yeah. And Angelica is the new Rachel. thank you so much for joining us this morning, Angelica.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And as you know, listeners, again, regular listeners will know, I love having people come into the studio, so it's great to have you actually here rather than just on the line. So tell us what's happening in the Beetaloo Basin and why we should be worried about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think just to start with, we're talking about an area quite far from many of us tuning in here in Melbourne. So I want to take you all on a bit of a journey up to one of the most pristine, untouched parts of Northern Australia. It's up near the Gulf of Carpentaria. You know, think of vast red dirt country, ancient bushlands, and huge reserves of fresh groundwater that are flowing beneath the surface of this land. And this land is really, it's land that traditional owners have cared for tens of thousands of years. But right now, we have these gas companies that want to tear right through it to do something called fracking, which gets all this gas up from the
surface. Which is banned in Victoria.
Which exactly is banned in Victoria and Tasmania due to health concerns concerning birth defects, asthma, all sorts of potential cancers as well that are associated. But yeah, there's this company called APA Group. They're Australia's biggest domestic gas pipeline company.
And I have to admit, I'd never heard of them until I got the information from you earlier this week.
Yeah, they kind of fly quite under the radar, and they market themselves as a bit of a infrastructure company, and they did actually have some investments and were working towards a transition towards renewable energy. However, they have decided to double down on gas as this year. They've made a bigger bit of a shift towards gas, and we found that through our own findings. And as part of that, they're looking at the Beetaloo Basin, this pristine area up in the NT. And they're working with two companies, one called it was formerly called Empire Energy, now has changed the name to Beetaloo Energy, and Tamboran Resources.
And regular listeners will have heard of Tamboran quite a bit, I suspect.
Yes. Well, they're working to essentially frack this area and build hundreds, potentially even thousands, of gas wells up on this country, carving pipelines across this really fragile ecosystem. Essentially to unlock fracking in the Beetaloo Basin. But it's really important to understand that this project actually hasn't fully unlocked investment yet, which means we actually do have time to stop them. There is a chance here. However, if it does go ahead, it could unlock over 1.1 billion tonnes of climate pollution. Now, just to kind of wrap your head around that, that's the equivalent of running Australia's biggest, dirtiest coal plant for more than 80 years.
It's insane.
And it's being laid right through this sacred country and communities that are already on the front lines of climate change.
Yeah, we had the traditional owners from the NT, those that are, as you say, on the front lines, came down to Melbourne on a roadshow, and I mean other parts of East Coast last year, talking about how they are a sacrificial zone, and that we here in Victoria need to play an active role in understanding the sacrifices that are being made by traditional owners in the Northern Territory. And it strikes me, because where's the gas that should this go ahead? Where's that gas destined?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. So, you know, we released a new report, Market Forces released a new report, and this analysis essentially found that, you know, Beetaloo Energy's own projections, this is publicly available information, show that over 80% of this gas is destined for export. So this idea and this narrative that we need to frack the Beetaloo and we need this gas for domestic use is complete and utter rubbish. And it's been completely disproved. A lot of it is going to go offshore. It's going to go to areas in Asia. It's going to go to Japan and all sorts of places. But we actually, most of this gas is not going to help you lower the cost of your bills. It's not going to help you with your power prices. It's not going to help us here on the east coast of Australia specifically. It's destined for export, and we know that quite clearly. The companies themselves have told us that, because that's how they make their money, through export prices.
And also, I mean, I saw some stats recently that show that Victoria's gas consumption has been dropping drastically over the course of the last, I think, 5 years. So we are getting off gas. And hopefully there isn't going to be much of a domestic market here in Victoria, at least.
Yeah, and even the gas that we do need, we can use that using just existing supplies. We actually do not need any new gas projects in Australia. And many of the current gas projects that we do have, again, a lot of it does go offshore. It goes to exports. And essentially here in Victoria, you're paying export prices for domestic gas. So it is complete and utter rubbish, again. And it's just really important to know that we don't need any new projects, quite frankly, and that's just quite clear.
Now, tell us a bit about the current campaign that Market Forces is running.
Yeah, absolutely. So due to, you know, we found out this work that this company APA Group is enabling fracking in the Beetaloo Basin, it's really important that we work to raise awareness and, you know, showcase what people can do in their everyday lives to try and stop it, because we don't need the gas at the end of the day. We know fracking's bad for climate, it's bad for people's health, it's bad for nature, and we frankly don't need the gas. There's no logical reason for Australians to have it. So there are a few things here. So one thing is that all four of the major banks are involved in financing these projects and in financing APA Group.
Don't they have commitments that they've made?
Yes, exactly. So they all have net zero goals. They've all signed up to try and halt global warming to well below 2 degrees of warming, in line with the Paris Agreement. And so, yeah, this actual funding of these projects and of this fracking goes directly against that. And you know, essentially you've got ANZ, NAB, Westpac and CommBank that have all been shown as lenders or enablers mm-hmm. of APA Group, the company. The particular worst of all of them is actually Macquarie Bank. Oh. They recently backed Beetaloo Energy, formerly mm-hmm. Empire Energy, with a $65 million deal. So directly backing the company fracking the area. And these banks, essentially, they're putting profits over people and planet, and they can't say they weren't warned. Community opposition is very clear. It's loud. Yep. It's growing. And we found through a recent YouGov survey that more than one in three Australians would actually switch their bank if they found out it was funding companies, funding the expansion of gas fracking. So science is clear and Australians' views on the topic are quite clear. Most Australians want clean renewable energy. They need to make mm-hmm. that clear to their banks. You know, we're all bank customers. Yeah. We all have a super fund. We all have friends and family. And so I would say those are the ways, you know, you can kind of mobilise. So yeah, in terms of specific actions and things that we're working on, we're working, you know, with companies, with bank customers, super funds, all sorts of things to halt this through any way we can. And yeah, so I guess I would say go onto our website if you're interested in doing something.
And we'll put a link to that in the show notes, yep. Of course.
Marketforces.org.au. click on our email action to email APA. It takes literally 30 seconds mm-hmm. to send a message from our website and telling them to scrap this pipeline. Pressure your bank or super fund. They, you know, they care about what their customers think. Mm-hmm. Ask them to cut ties with companies backing, you know, Beetaloo fracking. UniSuper actually last year sold all their shares in APA Group. And that was after significant public pressure. So, you know, pressure does work. We know it does. And yeah, just talk about it. Talk about it with your friends. Talk about it with your family. Have these conversations. We're all part of the network.
And I think particularly, as you say, that myth-busting of we need more gas when we really don't. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'd just like, we've got a little bit of time to touch upon, is the gas for exports thing as well, because we know that Japan's gas consumption is falling drastically as well. Mm-hmm. Why are we exporting gas to a country that's not going to be using it?
The reality with Japan is it actually onsells a lot of its gas to other areas, particularly in Asia. Mm-hmm. And that gas can actually lead to almost like trapping certain communities into gas. So communities that may have switched to renewables or may have invested in renewables, you know, we have Japan who goes and essentially builds these LNG you know, import terminals. Mm-hmm. They make it easier to convert LNG as liquid natural gas, for those who may not know. So when it's transported, it's transformed into a liquid state, and then to actually use it, you have to re-transform it into a gaseous state. Mm-hmm. And so Japan is actually building that infrastructure to do that in a lot of these smaller, you know, lesser developed areas.
Like gas pushes.
Yeah, essentially. And Australia's enabling it.
It's really helping to, my understanding, it's stopping that jump to renewables by forcing them into this dependency.
Renewables also are a great way for sovereignty and self-determination because the sun's there. You can't own the sun. You can't own the wind.
Yeah.
So it's just constantly generating, but gas, someone has to give you the gas. Yeah.
Especially if you don't have your own supply.
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just, I think it's really important for people to be aware that, you know, maybe we don't have fracking here in Victoria, and there's a reason why it was banned.
Yep.
Like if governments have banned this, it's because they know the health implications. Mm. They know that we don't need more gas from here. Even if there were reserves, we don't need it. Yep. I would just tell everyone that, you know, APA and their partners, Beetaloo Energy, formerly Empire Energy, and Tambran Resources, they want to profit off fracking at the expense of our clean air, our fresh water, and our stable climate, the stable climate that our kids need to survive and grow
and
up.
Our Indigenous heritage and communities.
Yes, exactly. You know, exactly. Yeah. If we want to ever talk about closing the gap or, you know, justice for First Nations communities, none of that is worth a grain of salt if we go ahead.
Yeah, and that picture you painted at the outset too, you sort of can't help wonder, you know, how widely spread the message it can be up there. As you said, it's very important to tell your friends about this, to look at the Market Forces website, educate yourself about it, because people need to talk about it beyond that region, don't they?
Yeah. Completely. Yeah.
We need to break through our own little bubbles, and it starts with the kind of richer areas, I would say, maybe on the East Coast, that we're privileged. We don't have the fracking here. We don't have to worry about those impacts. So I would argue we have a bit of a moral and ethical duty to do that.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Angelica.
So thanks so much for having me.
And that was Angelica, the gas campaigner from Market Forces, talking about what you can do to help stop fracking in the Beetaloo Basin and stop the financing of fracking in the Beetaloo Basin.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favourite radio program is produced? On Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2025. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July. See you then. Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Hi everyone. My name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website 3cr.org.au or you can ring on 94198377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
And we're back, 3CR Wednesday breakfast. It's now 2 minutes past eight. And we're joined by Kelly Flanagan, a Wiradjuri woman recently released from the Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, a women's maximum security prison, and the organiser of a rally this afternoon at 121 Exhibition Street, Melbourne, rallying outside the Office for Victoria Corrections to stop the human rights abuses at Dame Phyllis Frost Centre. Thank you so much for joining us this morning,
Thank
Kelly.
You for having me. I love being here.
Thanks for coming. Here.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you. I've been admiring all of your tireless efforts and extremely brave and staunch advocacy.
Thank you.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what this is about this afternoon.
Yeah, definitely. So I was incarcerated for 3 years. So the last couple of years in Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, the lockdowns are just incredible. So we're talking about like constant lockdowns, not coming out of your cell. The staff are pretty much pissed off that they have lost their overtime and they are just organising like an industrial-like action and not coming in, which is creating harm for the women that are inside. So mental health is increased, declining mental health is increased. Talking about suicide attempts on a huge, huge level. And people are not kind of, management are not really talking about it. They're just, you know, ignoring that it's happening. So when I got out, March 22, I was like, this just can't happen. So I've just been so noisy after I've been out. I've been running amok online. I've been, there has been a few consequences for it, but it's all worth it in the end, right? Like, And today's going to be amazing. So get out there and support the women and, yeah, make some noise. Let them know that they can't keep getting away with it and that there's someone who gives, yeah, who cares. So, yeah.
And the conditions at the Dame Phyllis Frost Center, I'm reading here that there were 5 out of 7 suicide attempts in March were First Nations women. And the brutal lockdowns include people being denied food, water, medical care, family contact. It sounds really horrific.
Yeah, and I know, like, some people when I've spoke about this, it's like, there's no way that can be happening in Australia. Mm. Yeah. It's happening. It's 100% happening. And it's, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like one of those things you can't believe it until you're there, right? And I'm not saying every day you're gone without food. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there has been circumstances and times over the 106 lockdown days where I have recorded no dinner, not being allowed dinner, not being allowed medical care. My lawyer has actually recorded the fact that they've cancelled appointments and I haven't been able to see her. So, like, that's from a third-party person. That's just not me saying it. I've challenged the minister to come and speak with me and say, so I could have a meeting with him to discuss this, and he's, like, blocked me. Mm. He will not return my emails. He won't, you know. So that goes to show in itself the kind of things that the kind of lengths they're willing to go to.
Correct me if I'm wrong, there was staff reductions made some years ago, wasn't there? And they've never been sort of addressed in terms of correcting that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's what's really important to remember is that before the new general manager and Morgan started, we had enough staff. We were not locked down. So what's happened is this new general manager has come in. She's gone, you know what, we're cutting overtime. We're cutting the extra shifts. So everyone needs to go home. They're only allowed 8 hours overtime a week. So what in turn that's doing is the people that are working in the environment are going, you know what, we're all going to band together. We're going to create industrial-like action and we're not going to show up to our shift. We're going to conduct, like, you know, orchestrate these kind of these days off or whatever it is. So that's what's actually happening. So it's not a matter of shortage of staff because there's plenty of staff. It's only been since the new GM came in and started cutting the overtime hours that it's been a problem. Okay. Yeah, so I really wanted to push that because we don't need any more staff. We have heaps of staff there. Right. It's just they're not showing up because they want their overtime back. Mm. So I know it's appalling. Money, you know, money over human rights. Like,
yeah, but that does seem to be the usual sort of calculations that are made these days.
Exactly, especially towards vulnerable people, Indigenous people.
Yeah.
And, you know, touching on the suicide attempts, right? Like there's 7 suicide attempts. I can't even acknowledge how difficult that was to be in the presence of, like a near fatal, couple cells down from me.
Yeah.
It broke my soul. Absolutely. It absolutely broke my soul. Like I come out, that happened 2 days before I got out.
Yeah.
That has been the passion and the drive for this is that can't be allowed to happen. Yeah. Yeah. It's horrific.
Yeah.
And maybe, I mean, I'd also like to talk a bit about the racism that underpins all this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I received a letter a couple of days ago saying that the prison had actually lost my artwork. So I'm a painter. This is the kind of behaviour that they do. They will hit you kind of where it hurts. The art for me is like my life. Mm. I love it. So this is what they've done. They've sent me a letter. There's been artwork missing. They've had months to try and locate it. They sent me a letter going, you know, look, we can't locate it. We're sorry about that, but we've done everything we could. Mm. And that's just one of the things they've done since I've been out. There's been other things as well that have targeted me and my racial, you know, my race. So,
absolutely.
But you decided you're still going to keep making some noise, like you said.
Oh, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going nowhere. And you know what? With getting that letter, and I shared it online because I want everyone to see what it's about and the way they operate. But it's just made me more fierce. Mm. Like I'm got up this morning and I'm ready to go. Yeah. So let's go out and make a scene and hold them accountable.
Yeah. And you have some demands, a list of demands that you've made.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, so I think it's important for everyone to know that at the end of this, we are seeking some demands from the minister. One of them is ending the lockdowns at Dame Phyllis Frost Centre immediately. We need to stand down the general manager of Dame Phyllis Frost Centre for a full investigation into her conduct that resulted in the human rights breaches. disclose the practices, reasons and decision-making criteria, the list of all units locked down and the number of women impacted in each, including the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, and the length of time of each lockdown. They need to disclose strategies implemented to date to address the lockdowns and psychological injuries caused by the lockdowns. Disclose the precautions in place to ensure there is access to culturally safe supports during the lockdowns. Disclose all documents that prove that culturally specific services had been delivered to First Nations people throughout the lockdowns. We recommend a Royal Commission to investigate the extent to which imprisoned women were deprived access to legal visits and support to prepare for court matters. That is huge because there's been so many women who have been denied court preparation appointments, and which obviously causes them not to be able to go to court until they have those appointments. So
yeah.
That one's really important. The extent to which the imprisoned women were denied access to food and clean water while being in their cells during lockdown. The extent to which the imprisoned women were cut off from engaging with family, children, friends and support persons due to no access to phones, Zooms or in-person visits. The extent to which imprisoned women were denied medical services such as seeing doctors, nurses, mental health practitioners and drug and alcohol supports. The extent to which imprisoned women's housing appointments, parole preparation and parole appointments were cancelled with no notice given and no information provided. And lastly, the practices, reasons and decision-making criteria, the list of all units locked down and the number of women impacted in each, including the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and the length of each lockdown. The person responsible for making decisions to proceed with lockdown since June 2023, the harm and effect it had and continues to have on women inside. The provisions DPFC has put in place to ensure these lockdowns cease immediately and in future situations. To determine the accountability of departments and individuals making decisions resulting in human rights abuses and harm suffered by the imprisoned women. What support and individualised services are required to assure that the impacted women are addressing the harms that has been caused by the lockdowns? And whether the harm suffered by the impacted women is by its nature an exceptional circumstance. So that's our demands. It's a big list, but it's all
and is
really
this available online?
It is available online. So there's a lot of posts and stuff floating about, and we'll also be handing out flyers today as well with the minister's details attached to the bottom. We think that everybody should contact the minister and ask him what he's doing. Yeah.
Getting goosebumps cool. Thinking about that rally.
That's yeah, yeah, yeah. Hopefully yeah. It's going to be. Yeah. You know, we've got some shirts going.
Yeah. Kelly's wearing a great shirt that says, "Warning, Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, human rights breaches in progress."
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of these to go around. So come down and get a shirt and run amok with me.
Absolutely. So that's at this afternoon at 12 p.m. at the Corrections Minister office at 121 Exhibition Street in Melbourne. Come along if you're free. Thanks so much for your time, Kelly. Was there any last things you'd like to mention before we let you go?
No, thanks for having me. I feel like these are such important issues, and you know, we can support the people who have no voices and the most vulnerable in our community. And you know, women, just because my experience is attached to that, but they have no one, right? We are their voice. Mm. And it's really important to come down today and, you know, come and support what we're doing.
100%. Thanks. Thanks very much, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
And we'll hope to chat with you again shortly.
Mm. Well, hopefully it'll be resolved. We won't need to.
Let's hope so. Yeah, exactly.
But if not, it'd be great to have you back on.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
It's almost a quarter past eight, and we're going to get our next guest on the phone. But in the meantime, here's a little bit of rock and roll to help your Wednesday morning. Pedro Rodriguez, he's in a demon's God, I love that song. In fact, Red, who's sadly no longer with us, his mighty band, the Inner Demons, are playing a show in a couple of weeks, Saturday the 26th. Celebrate his life. Great, great man. Melbourne musician. Actually lived down on the coast, down on the peninsula. So his band's coming together. His great friends coming together to play at the Cherry Bar on the 26th. With a couple other bands, and be a good night. We're lucky enough, after just speaking with Kelly, to now have on the phone Claire Hansen from Save Public Housing Collective. Hello, Claire.
Did you say lucky enough?
Yes, you bet I did. I'm very happy we got to. Sorry?
Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm very happy we got to. Thanks for hanging on the phone there for us. Yes, from the Save Public Housing Collective, who are having a very important rally. I'll say it at the top and we'll repeat it at the end. On August the 2nd, that's Saturday, August the 2nd at 11 a.m, and that is at the State Library of Victoria, to put more attention on what is quite frankly a very dire situation around the private public housing and the towers in Carlton, North Melbourne, and Flemington. If you could just refresh our listeners' memory about the sort of history of this situation.
Yeah, I certainly can.
Thanks.
It started a few years ago. Mm. Now, the whole agenda to pull down all public housing and to hand it over to, they call community housing providers, but it's private, you know. It's not public. It's not owned by the government. It's not run by the government. So that is still the master plan, if you will.
In excess of six and a half thousand properties we're talking about.
Well, yes, indeed. I would say more than that, actually.
And more than that,
yeah. Yeah, you count up all the 44 towers,
yep.
And then you've got the walk-ups as well across Melbourne. They're not safe. I live on a walk-up estate with 77 acres. You think that's not valuable to someone? Yeah, exactly. So,
and numbers are important. Sorry to interrupt. We're talking about 10,000 people, aren't we?
Talking about what?
We're talking about 10,000 people.
Yeah, oh, easily.
The homes
10,000
people
that we know about.
Yeah,
you know, who knows how many people are living here? But we know there are over 100,000 on the waiting list. So I mean, if they're going to, and they say they'll relocate people while they're being, while these new estates are being built for community providers, if they've got the stock to rehome these people, why have we got such a waiting list?
Good question.
If the stock is there, why are you not putting people who are desperately homeless, living in their cars, into that stock? Anyway, that's a question that we shout from the rooftops. But, the towers, as we know, it was Dan Andrews' last parting gift. They're pulling down all the towers.
Mm.
And certainly John Holland have been paid, by the Victorian government $100 million already for the contract to pull down, you mentioned them, the two towers at Flemington and one in North Melbourne. Now, they're mostly empty. The tenants there have been so battered and bruised by Homes Victoria that they just end up going. I mean, if you just batter people hard enough, you will bend them to your will.
Mm.
So that's what's happened. I would say only a handful of the floors are still occupied. But while there are people still there, they can't pull them down.
Mm.
Clearly can't do that. But they really want people out so they can start. They would like to start this year.
And they've essentially been given the green light by the most recent court action, which was taken, found in favour, I suppose, essentially of the government.
Of Homes Victoria.
Of the government, Some of those reasons for why the towers are being removed still haven't actually been made public, have they, by the government?
Well, that was one of the Inner Melbourne Legal Centre went in with the court case you just mentioned.
Mm.
We were demanding that they show us why the evidence as to their claim that the towers were no longer fit for purpose, were outdated and could not be retrofitted and brought up to 2025 standards. You know, all of these structural problems, you know, plumbing problems. The court ruled in their favour that they did not have to show us that work. And yet we have to show them. We've had the surveyors in. It's cost Office, an architectural pro bono group called Office, who've been helping us. It's cost them $100,000 just to get a surveyor to look at one tower. Yet the government, and we have to provide that proof to the government. Look, they're sound, but the court ruled in favour that the government did not have to provide evidence to the people. And let's not forget, the people own those buildings at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
They belong to us, not the government, us. We don't have to be shown the reasons why the government, you know, who say they have evidence, we don't have to be shown that evidence that the buildings are unfit.
It's been a long, hard fight, this one, hasn't it, Claire? It's taken a toll.
Yeah, it is. It's been this has not been a slow burn.
No.
This has been in the works for years, decades probably. Yeah.
I can actually hear it must be very upsetting for you and not just you and the people involved with the Safe Public Housing Collective, but we're talking about all of the residents. How are you sort of coping just at the moment with where it is at? Because it does look like these demolitions are going to take place. And again, we'll talk about the time and place of the rally. But yep. Where do you go from here?
While the buildings are standing and while there are people still in them, we keep fighting until the very last person is ejected.
Put on your...
We're not going to stop. You know, in fact, there's a. I've just slipped this one in quickly, if I could.
Yes.
Starting on the 25th of this month and running for 1 month at the Melbourne School of Design Gallery at Melbourne Uni is a scale model size of the towers. Ascot Vale Estate and the Barrack Beacon Estate that was torn down recently. Mm. Little scale models of them, all retrofitted.
Right.
I can't wait to see it, to be honest, with earthquake proofing on the towers. And fantastic. I'm really excited to see that. So that's on. And what did we say? Where do we go from here? Oh, yes. So I get people to look at that. And as I said, we're not going to stop fighting this thing. I think, to be honest, we will probably lose the first of the towers because I don't think people are taking it very seriously.
Mm.
You know, there was a big shock horror when it was first announced from a lot of people, but I think when the first tower gets pulled down, people might start taking it more seriously, that this is really happening. Can you imagine Melbourne skyline without the towers?
Mm.
We're talking about a whole entire new Melbourne
without those.
I mean, it's part of our skyline.
And just touching on what you said about those models, because they represent what, I suppose, reports have shown is that these buildings can be retrofitted.
Absolutely. The work has been done and we have the work, the evidence, we have the people on board, you know, people who are professionals at this, not just people like me who speak a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was just going to say we love people who speak a lot.
Claire, look, We've cut it a bit fine, but I'm so happy that we got to you. You guys have done amazing work. You should be congratulated. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Shout it from the top of the towers.
Mm. Well, thank you to 3CR because you've backed us all the way. You really have.
And that's...
So I need a locker at your studio. My own locker.
We'll look into it. Add anything to this if you'd like. The rally, Save Public Housing, the mass rally to save the towers, takes place on Saturday, the 2nd of August at 11 a.m. from the State Library of Victoria.
That's right, past the Homes Victoria office on Lonsdale Street and up to the steps of Parliament. Yep, indeed.
And we'll put a link to your website in our show notes.
Thanks, Sonia.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Claire. Have a good morning.
Thanks so much for us. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was...
Claire Hansen, yes.
Right.
Save Public Housing Collective.
Do we have time for some community announcements or shall we go straight to a rundown of the show?
Oh, we might have time for a couple.
Okay. Yeah, I think we have time. Yeah.
All right.
Cracking along at a great pace this morning.
There are two Understanding Palestine workshops this weekend. There's going to be the usual Sunday one at Black Spark Cultural Centre at 4:30 with Yusuf Al-Ramawi. I went to one of them finally recently and I highly recommend them. So also for those that are in the West, there will be an Understanding Palestine lecture at Mama Chen's on Saturday the 19th of June. I think from 2 p.m. till 5 p.m. there'll also be live Arabic music and a Q&A and things.
They sound
so
great.
They both sound great.
Yes, and you can vouch for them.
And I can vouch
excellent.
For them. And we also broadcast some of them. But yeah, sorry, Jesse.
Yeah. I'm just going to plug a couple of the Our Warrior story of Uncle Robbie Thorpe's documentaries that are coming up. There's one on Cinema Nova in Carlton on the 23rd of July at 6:20 p.m. And I mentioned last week that I've been told if they can sell 80% of the tickets for this screening, Cinema Nova will put on a special run of the Our Warrior documentary. Meaning, I don't know how long it is exactly, but they'll do a regular sort of run at Nova instead of just just the one-off ones.
And then also a shout-out for the convergence on Canberra for the sanction Israel now. That will be happening this weekend from Sunday until Tuesday, starting at 2 p.m. at Parliament House in Canberra. So the call is to sanction the State of Israel in response to the genocide in Palestine.
Very good. Thank you. Shout out to Jesse for your magnificent work on the dials and buttons this morning.
Oh, thanks, yep. Marty.
Wonderful. And all of our wonderful guests who included...
Yes, we had Claire Hansen from Save Public Housing Collective mm-hmm. on the towers and the upcoming rally. Before that, we had Kelly Flanagan, a Wiradjuri woman who was recently released from the Dame Phyllis Frost Centre and is coordinating a rally today at 12 p.m. outside the Minister for Corrections, Victoria Corrections office at 121 Exhibition Street. Before that, we had Angelica from Market Forces on fracking in the Beetaloo Basin and the people who were funding it. Before that, we had Roscoe Lee Brown of Radio Rada discussing Kanaki and Indigenous liberation news from our region. And finally, at the beginning of the show, we had an interview with two Iranian activists discussing a bit of analysis on the 12-day war between Israel and Iran and what we can expect going forward. And that's all we have time for this morning. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up now is Stick Together.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.